At some point in our history, enough people considered the first 100 days of a new president's time in office to be important enough to make it a benchmark. As President Trump hit that 100-day mark, there were some who wanted to just say that the ship was steady, sailing smoothly. Others bemoan that the president has yet to tear down Obamacare, build the wall, revamp the tax code, and solve the Middle East and North Korea situations. The next guest joins us to offer his expert analysis of President Trump's first 100 days in office. He's a professor of political science at St. Peter's University. Previous career, senior reporter of Time Magazine, Professor Alan Sanders. Thanks for being here today, sir.
My pleasure. How are you?
Great to have you here at St. Peter's University website, stpeters.edu. And well, I just want to start off with this benchmark of 100 days. As a political observer that you are, have you ever seen this much onus placed upon 100 days of a president's term?
Well, not exactly. I think part of it is because Donald Trump himself set out the 100-day mark as,
that's
as the
true.
Benchmark. And because he did that, and of course everybody is assessing him on that self-imposed benchmark. In terms of what he has accomplished, well, legislatively, not very much. And he's learning, like all presidents, that Congress is a slow-moving institution, deliberative and obstreperous at various times. And a president needs to work and work with Congress very much. The president is learning that the hard way, and so far his legislative success have been minimal.
Yeah, certainly he's accomplished far more, pretty much everything, with the exception of the Supreme Court nomination through executive orders.
Well, that's right. But even if you look closely at the executive orders, most of them are aspirational. They're instructions to the agencies to review, to report, to study various aspects of the policies he's espoused. Very few executive orders actually amount to an actual order to do something. The major one, of course, as you point out, is the immigration and travel bans that he has imposed. But he's discovered, like all presidents, that the courts are the third branch of government, and they will look at those orders to see whether they comply with the law as well as the Constitution. And there, of course, he's met some obstacles three times now from involving three separate lawsuits or three separate cases, I should say.
So hypothetically, if the president used his philosophy, as you just explained accurately, with executive orders of incremental steps, if he maybe took that approach with his dealings with Congress, we might have a different picture.
Well, that's right. When you're dealing with Congress, what you really need to do is to prioritize. Congress can only swallow so much legislative work and so much of a legislative agenda because it takes weeks and months to bring everybody on board. A president needs to vote to work with something that's called a voting nucleus. That is to say, he will always have a number of supporters, presumably a large number of supporters, but often that's not enough to get the majority that he needs to get something through one or the other chamber. So you have to work with the members at the edges. You have to lobby. You have to bargain. You have to make promises. You have to offer favors. That's just the nature of the process. The process was built on compromise, and the president has to learn how to work that. All presidents have a learning curve. At the beginning of their term, Donald Trump is having his own right now.
Which he admitted in a couple of interviews just the other day with Reuters and I believe the Washington Examiner, saying that there's a lot more to this job, not that he's not capable of dealing with the workload, but it's a lot different than what he had anticipated it to be.
Well, that's right. And I think one of the major differences between business compromises and political compromises is that in the business world, if you can't reach a compromise with another party, you can walk away and deal with another party and hopefully get a better deal. In government, of course, you can't walk away. You are always dealing with the same people. So if you can't get a deal with a group of people today, it's going to be the same group of people that are going to be around the next day. And so it's a much more difficult task. It's a much more challenging task, and I think he's learning that.
I'm with Professor Alan Sanders, who's a professor of political science at St. Peter's University. stpeters.edu is their website. And you were listening to Issues and Ideas. Is there a value of just showing up at the party to make the party happier? Case in point, the Trump post-election rally in the markets stat I saw was it's the third best ever. JFK had the best post-election bump, George Herbert Walker Bush the second, with Trump showing an 11% gain in the markets.
Well, I think for every president, popular support, whether you gauge it by polls or whether you gauge it by the stock market or some intangible out there, is always important because if a president comes across as being popular, either popular economically or with Wall Street or with the market or with the general population in general, it makes it more difficult for opponents in Congress to stand up to the president and, of course, much easier for those who support him to stand by him. It creates a political climate. And political climate is one of the vantage points that the president, any president, can exploit in order to get his agenda through the Congress.
Some have said or observed that President Trump has succeeded more in foreign affairs than domestic policies. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I think it's much too early to say. Certainly, this president has shown a willingness to be much more muscular than Barack Obama, and many of the critics of President Obama's administration pointed that out, that President Obama was not muscular enough, and that that led to a rise of Russian influence, as well as Chinese influence, and, of course, a comeback for Iran. This president has shown a willingness to be more muscular. He, of course, has taken military action in Syria and Afghanistan. The reason it's too early to tell is we don't really know what the follow-up is. There hasn't been any clear articulation of where the president wants to go in Syria, where he wants to go in Afghanistan. And, of course, right now we have North Korea, and we really don't know what the president's intentions, what the long-term plan regarding that truly are. So it's certainly more muscular, but we don't know where that muscle is going to lead us to.
We are seeing, though, where Trump is actually doing something maybe many thought was probably unthinkable, getting China to do some of the heavy lifting for us in regards to North Korea.
That's right, and I think many people will view that as a positive step because China, of course, is just as concerned as the United States about the nuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the North Korean program in particular. But they've been willing so far or up until now not to do very much about it, just to sort of sit back. President Trump has talked to them, has made it clear to them, has suggested that the danger to them is just as important as the U.S., and he's pointed out to them that if China doesn't do anything, the president is willing to take action. But, of course, we don't know exactly what the action is.
And on almost the other side of the world, with how much of a value in helping temper down hostilities in the Middle East did a Trump administration reaffirming support for Israel play a role in?
Well, I think the reaffirmation of support for Israel is important for the stability of that area because many people, of course, always think it's easy for Israel to give in to concessions, and there's always pressure on Israel to give in on this or that. What many people forget is that the other side that's asking for concessions is largely offering promises, whereas Israel actually holds tangible territory in order to make those compromises. So to the extent that the administration is saying Israel needs to have ironclad, secure promises with hopefully some tangible benefits or some tangible evidence, that's important for the stability because in the Middle East, as we well know, promises today are not necessarily the promises that we will be lived up to in the future. So the real issue is concrete proposals, concrete and tangible proposals from both sides, and so far there haven't been any. So to the extent he insists on that and says Israel needs tangible protection and tangible agreements from the other side, I think that should help stability. But of course it means that any agreement really is far off into the future.
Wrapping our time with Professor Alan Sanders, Professor of Political Science at St. Peter's University, and the website stpeters.edu here on Issues and Ideas. Back in the campaign, then-candidate Trump promised to tear up trade agreements that were not profitable, not fair for America. One in the crosshairs was NAFTA. And now he's saying that this is something that could be reworked and improved upon, which a lot of the news media are jumping on him as a flip-flop. But if you think back to when Trump met with the Mexican president after that meeting, the Mexican president had said that, well, we can probably do something better and make NAFTA a more fair and equitable deal. So it's really, really maybe Trump remembering that there's unity and there's a common level of workability between himself and the Mexican president with NAFTA.
Well, I think you can look at it either way. You can look at it either as hypocrisy or a promise that was never intended to be kept, or as the learning curve presidency, one who is learning that what you say in a campaign isn't exactly what you can do, and therefore you need to adjust your strategy. Certainly, he campaigned very hard, saying that NAFTA was a terrible deal, a horrible deal, needed to be scrapped. It was a major cause of economic problems in the United States. But now, of course, he's saying, well, it is problematic, but it's something that can just be tinkered with and improved so that the economic situation here and with the other countries will work. You know, he just this week said that, you know, he loves Canada, he loves Mexico. These are wonderful countries. These are great countries. That's not what he was saying about Mexico when he was campaigning. So either you're looking at hypocritical statements if you're critical of Donald Trump, or you're learning or you're saying that, well, he's a much more pragmatic person than people thought.
Just wrap things up. You mentioned how Trump has to work more with Congress. How much does Congress have to work more with a different type of president versus what many of those members have seen in the last, well, anywhere between 8 to legitimately 35 years almost?
Well, what's interesting is you're watching kind of a learning curve here for both, certainly for the president, as we've discussed, but also for Congress. You've got an unpredictable president in the sense that much of what he has said campaigning is not exactly what he's doing as president. You're also dealing with an administration that has lots of infighting, and Congress has to learn how to deal with that, who's really speaking for the president, for his administration. And then, of course, you've got a learning curve for members of Congress in terms of a shift in majority and minority. The Democrats have to learn now that they are in the minority, and you will see, and you are seeing, that as the minority party, they are adopting some of the same tactics that the Republicans did when they were in the minority. So everybody is learning to readapt to their new positions, and that's typical in a new administration and in a new political environment.
And as 2018 elections approach, so all those members have to realize, at least at this point in time, the president in the Oval Office still has the support of 98% of the people who put him in that Oval Office.
Well, that's right. And, you know, elections are always hovering in the background. That's one of the things that our founders made sure, that there would be at least elections every 2 years. And that is the way that they created a government that is receptive and responsive to popular sovereignty. So the people are very important. It's always in the mind of the politicians, and it's particularly in the minds of members of Congress, because for a member of Congress, that's the name of the game, to be reelected and to sit at the table of public policymaking. So they're very sensitive to that.
He's a professor of political science at St. Peter's University, previously senior reporter of Time magazine. Professor Alan Sanders, thanks for being here today.
My pleasure. Take care.